You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's political commentary.
With Professor Robert Patman this morning from the School of Politics at the University of Otago. Morena, Robert, how are you today?
Morena, I'm fine, thank you.
It's great to have you on the show. Thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
Going to have a bit of an international lens on what's happening politically at the moment. Let's start with Russia, because I feel like there's a lot to unpack here. For people who might have been sort of half-heartedly following the headlines over the last week, what has actually happened with this attempted coup? What's going on over there?
Well, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who led the coup and the head of the Wagner Group, this was a mercenary Russian group which was sanctioned by Mr. Putin and funded by him, actually, marched on Moscow, and the march was ended, so-called March for Justice, according to Prigozhin, by a deal in which Mr. Prigozhin went into exile and many of his followers would also be allowed to go. Mr. Putin said at one stage on Saturday morning that they were guilty of treason, and that implied that they'd be facing legal charges. But in fact, by Saturday evening, Mr. Putin allowed them to go. And one of the reasons he allowed them to go, we now know, is much of the Russian military were supporting Prigozhin. In fact, in the last 24 hours, we've learned that General Surovikin, one of Mr. who was expected to have an enhanced role in the invasion of Ukraine and has played a prominent role, has been arrested, and his deputy as well, because they colluded with Prigozhin. And that may explain why the coup went as far as it did.
Mm.
And many of us who watched it were struck by the fact that Prigozhin's Wagner force, a long military column of more than 20,000 personnel with equipment, were just allowed to go unimpeded through a succession of Russian cities. Well, the reason is because Prigozhin was getting support from the Russian from elements within the Russian military. We don't know why he precisely came to a stop when he did, but it may have been because his support that he'd been counting on from coming from Moscow.
Yeah.
Which meant that he could enter Moscow without any resistance at all and effectively displace Putin. Maybe that assurance that he wanted was not forthcoming, and he decided to turn back.
So in the wider picture of the war at the moment, what does this actually mean? What can we interpret from, I guess, this instability? Is that how you would interpret it?
I see this as the inevitable blowback or fallout from Mr. Putin's catastrophic strategic misjudgment of invading Ukraine. It's been an utter disaster for Mr. Putin. He clearly was delusional in believing that he could almost swiftly and almost painlessly occupy a country of 44 million people, which was neighboring Russia. This is the problem with dictatorships, is that the leaders often get quite isolated and people around them only give them the information they want to hear, because Putin's removed most of the independent politicians and journalists in Russia. So the boss gets often the information what he wants to hear, but it was, you know, there's no secret that certain elements of the military and of the Russian security services were quite unhappy about the invasion. And unfortunately, for Mr. Putin, it's causing real domestic strain. Russia has lost a lot of casualties in the war.
Mm-hmm.
More than 100,000 Russians have died. They've only effectively occupied about 18% of Ukraine, and now Russia is on the receiving of a counteroffensive. In addition, the Russian economy has been hit by sanctions. The economy has been quite resilient because countries like India and China have enabled Russia to get around some of the sanctions by providing markets for their fossil fuel exports. But, I think, as I said to you, I think the crucial thing here is that fighting an unpopular war, which is very costly in human terms and also economic terms, is catching up with Mr. Putin. And With an authoritarian regime, of course, it's always difficult to tell precisely the level of support. But I think this coup attempt, which seems to have failed, is the beginning of instability for the Putin regime, because what caused the coup attempt, the factors in the background that we've just discussed, are still present.
Mm, absolutely. It's going to be a very interesting time to see what comes out of this. Let's talk a wee bit about China at the moment. Chris Hipkins is over there right now. What's the nature of his visit? Why is the Prime Minister in China at the moment?
Well, the Prime Minister is in China, I believe, principally to consolidate the economic relationship with China. It's also a chance for a new Prime Minister, Chris Hipkins, to get to know Xi Jinping and senior Chinese leadership. Mr. Hipkins took a large delegation with him, including the Minister for Tourism and a number of other senior officials, and also the Trade Minister, and business representatives. There's about 29 altogether, the delegation.
Wow, that's quite big.
From all accounts, it's gone relatively well. I think China is New Zealand's biggest trade partner. About 31% of our exports go to China. And while New Zealand is very keen to diversify away from trade dependence, at the moment, China is occupying rather too many. It's probably dominating our trade export picture too much. We'd like to get more markets so we're less dependent. There's another pressure here, apart from diversification, and that is to kickstart the economy, put it in a higher gear after the COVID period.
Mm.
And so I think China has seen a way of doing that. China provided, quite apart from being a lucrative market for our exports, principally agricultural exports, it's also the second biggest source of tourists to this country, or at least it was before COVID. So from Mr. Hipkins' point of view, it's a short-term move, I think, to boost economic links, make sure that, that we're hitting all the right buttons in relation to the Chinese economic connection. And that enables us in the long term to try to keep up this pressure for diversification.
No, you carry on.
I was just going to say, also, with an election looming, and Mr. Hipkins had made it clear as soon as he took over from Jacinda Ardern that he was very anxious to get New Zealand business firing on all cylinders. And I think you've got to see this visit to China in that context.
That was exactly what I was about to ask you. How does this sort of sit in an election year space? But I do sort of, I guess, have a second question to that. Is beyond this relationship, as you say, this is a kind of a short-term conversation and a sort of, strengthening or reassurance of that relationship. But is there any sort of indication that you've seen from Chris Hipkins' leadership that suggests what he might be thinking about in a sort of longer term sense when it comes to those trade relations?
All we can do is look at the fact that this government, led by Chris Hipkins, and the previous government, Jacinda Ardern, have repeatedly stressed the need to the business community in this country to look beyond China. The reason they're having difficulty doing that is because the returns on exports to China tend to be more lucrative than they are in other markets. I'm simplifying somewhat, but the country is making big efforts. We've signed free trade agreements with the UK and the EU in the last 12 months or so. So there is efforts underway. Another country that New Zealand would like to upgrade its trade relations with and its economic connections is Japan, and they're working hard on that. So there's efforts underway, but I think there was also a political motivation which could be seen as short-term and long-term, and that was we have been unhappy with the Chinese stance towards Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mr. Hipkins succeeded in apparently getting across some quite tough messages, but in a cordial way.
Mm.
Before he started his visit, he was asked by a journalist whether he agreed with Mr. Biden's characterization of Xi Jinping as a dictator. He said diplomatically that he would not call the Chinese leader that, use that term. And that went down very well with China. All the Chinese media praised Mr. Hipkins for pursuing a truly foreign policy, independent foreign policy. Of course, Mr. Hipkins may privately agree with Mr. Biden's characterization of the Chinese leader as a dictator, but he certainly has declined to use that sort of language in public diplomatic discourse.
Mm. It's a very interesting time, and I'll be fascinated to see what happens when he returns to New Zealand and we get a bit more of a conversation with him about it. But thank you so much for your time this morning,
Professor
Robert Patman. It's been great to have you on the show. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. Oh, what are we? Thursday.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ka kite, see ya.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.